Women's Soccer Review Podcast with Dwayne Rollins and Jonathan Tannenwald on the Sports Podcasting Network.
And welcome to the Women's Soccer Review. I am Dwayne Rollins in Toronto, Canada. Joining me in Philadelphia in the great United States is Jonathan Tannenwald. How are you doing today, Jonathan?
I'm doing pretty well. Lots to talk about with CONCACAF Women's Olympic qualifying, including the United States looking not so great in their first game. By the time the listeners hear this show, the second game might be over, so we will talk about the round of games that will be going on this Friday evening. It's Friday afternoon as we record, and we'll try to be a little generic, and we'll see what happens, of course, because whatever happens when we're done recording will surely be the opposite of whatever we talk about. There we go.
Fair enough. I'm confident to say that St. Kitts and Nevis is not going to win its second game based on what I saw in the first game. But let's put that on a shelf for a second, because something else happened during that game which does have some historical significance. Jonathan, Canada's Christine Sinclair passes Abby Wambach for the all-time lead in women's, well, not just women's, in soccer, international soccer history with 185 career goals. Jonathan, look, we both watched Sinclair a lot through the years, both in NWSL and internationally for Canada. This is clearly a great player that has scored a lot of goals, more than anyone else. But what are your thoughts on her finally catching Abby and surpassing her?
Look, we all know, who, as you said, you and I have watched her play for a long time. This was inevitable. It was going to happen. I was very happy that a lot of people down here on this side of the border, especially Abby Wambach, Mia Hamm, and the United States Soccer Federation, from its institutional social media accounts, all congratulated Sinclair, said very nice things about her. I thought that was pretty cool, because there is, and I'm sure many of the listeners know this, but not all might, there's quite a rivalry between the United States and Canada. It tends to go a little something like this. The United States women's team scores a lot of goals in a game and celebrates them. The Canadians get upset. The two teams play each other, and the U.S. has won every game or close to it, I think. I don't think Canada hasn't beaten the U.S. on the women's side in, what, it's 10-plus years, I think? It's been a long time.
2003.
Yeah, so it's been 17 years since Canada last beat the United States on the women's side. So it tends to go a little something like that, and I was glad that this all was handled in a classy manner. There wasn't any of the usual sort of sniping back and forth on Twitter that we have seen in the past. However, I have one issue with all of this, Glenn, and it's not going to surprise you. It's something that you and I have discussed for a long time. The record should not have been broken in this game. It should have been broken previously on Canadian soil in a friendly at home. And Canada has not played the Canadian women's team has not played a home game since last May. That's May of 2019, before the World Cup. They did not play any home games after the World Cup. I think that the Canadian fans deserve to watch this record get broken on home soil, whether in Toronto or Vancouver or Edmonton or Winnipeg or wherever it may be. And Dwayne, you and I have discussed on the show in the past that when Canadian national teams play home games, the Canadian Soccer Association loses money. My response to that now is what it has always been, which is too bad, do it anyway.
I think in this particular case, it would have been certainly nice. Now, the only caveat, the only defense I will give is that Christine Sinclair herself probably would not have been pushing for that. She's a very reserved and shy individual, for those who have never interacted with her, although she did seem quite genuinely and sincerely happy with passing the victory and with, you know, the nice messages that she received from celebrities and other U.S. women players like Abby Wambach, as you say. So yeah, there was that. Look, it was unfortunate. We had a chance on the main show on Soccer Today to talk to John Molinaro, who's down there covering the event for the Canadian Premier League's website, and he talked about how surreal it was to watch a world record be broken in front of friends and family, basically. Right. There was next to no one in the stadium. There's just a simple announcement made after the fact. There was a bit of a celebration by the Canadian women on the field, but it was not over the top. It was just something, another goal in what was a really non-competitive game, 11-0 the final in that game. Canada does have a friendly schedule for April 14th at BC Place against Australia, part of a three-game set. They're playing the Australians in what they hope to be preview games to the Olympics. But you know, that's going to be the same thing. They're going to wheel her out, I'm sure, not wheel her out, hopefully. They're going to walk her out on the field before the game, give her a plaque, and away they go. And then that's just the reserved nature of things. And it certainly would have been nice to have a celebration of her success, because it really is remarkable. And it was, look, the reaction on social media, for what that's worth, was quite quite nice to see. You know, the Prime Minister chirped in. You had, as you said, like people like Billie Jean King, like not necessarily in the soccer world. You had actors talking about her, just the general fans, obviously. It was a very exciting time. She led the sportcast. So she did get her due on the day, but it was reserved, as you say, and it's unfortunate. And I do think that in a general sense, there has been a conversation that started here that perhaps we've underappreciated her for years, even here in Canada. Certainly, when you look at a player who's never even been nominated for the Player of the Year for FIFA, not even made the short list before, that does seem a little bizarre that the all-time leading scorer would do that. That's because she's on a Canadian team that has underachieved at times, though, Jonathan. Do you think that she is appreciated in the women's soccer community to the level that is appropriate, though?
I think within the women's soccer community, absolutely. Those who know her, those who watch her, and as you just alluded to, Dwayne, I think it has to be said, those who know that the rest of the Canadian program has not been good enough in all these recent years, and indeed going back a good ways now. There have been good players, but not good enough to beat the United States, not good enough to finish better than bronze in a major tournament. Her medals, her championships have come with clubs, and I think that part of her career has been under-recognized, because we tend to undersell the club game and club accomplishments when looking at things like, for example, FIFA Player of the Year awards and so on. I'm a little surprised that she hasn't even made a short list for any Player of the Year awards. I can't say I'm surprised that she hasn't won an award, of them. And that, and we talk about her recognition in the women's soccer community. I should clarify that when I talk about the women's soccer community, I'm talking about people who actually follow the game closely, which is the United States, Canada, a few places in Europe and Australia. It's not more than that, and it's unfortunate, because the FIFA awards are voted on by representatives in the entire world who aren't always paying attention, which is why Carly Lloyd won it twice and Marta won it a bunch of times and so on and so forth. You know, I don't have an easy answer, but the one thing that I can say from my own experiences and from having been up there a lot is something that you and I have discussed in these last few minutes, which is that in her own country, I don't think she has been, I'm going to use a bad word, Dwayne, marketed enough. And, you know, she's not a big charismatic type in the way that some of the American stars are. We understand that. But I'm still going to blame the CSA for not doing their part. And it does go back to what I said a few minutes ago. When you're losing money on playing home games, which is the sort of way that you build a fan base and get attention, I'm a little tired of hearing that as an excuse.
Well, fair enough. In their slight defense, they did have some nice collateral that was ready to go on final whistle after she broke the record. So at least they did get that right. There was some nice videos circulating around. But not much to say about the game itself. If we segue out of the record, 11-0 against a team that you would expect to win handily, and they did. The more interesting game, of course, was the other game in that pool, the Mexican-Jamaican game. A 1-0 victory for the Mexicans in there. A little bit lucky of a one. A lot of chances for Jamaica that they just could not convert in. What were your thoughts on that pool in general and the Mexican Jamaica game, Jonathan?
Well, it puts Mexico in the driver's seat to finish second in the group, which is nice. I'm very worried about Jamaica. They needed to win. They probably needed to at least draw. Excuse me, if not win that game. And now they're in trouble. And I wrote a big piece before the qualifying tournament started about the state of Jamaica's program. I spoke with Hugh Menzies, their former coach, the one who took them to the World Cup last year and then resigned in December because he had not been fully paid, nor had his players been fully paid. And for the listeners who don't know, the Jamaican Federation does not properly fund their team. The money comes from Sadella Marley, yes, of the Bob Marley family. That's not the way it should be, straight up. It's the way it is, and the Jamaican Federation has, you know, publicly, profoundly thanked Sadella Marley many times when she has stepped up. but they shouldn't be doing that. They should be funding it themselves. And for people who say that they don't have the money, I'm going to disagree and say they do have the money. And I would like to see CONCACAF and FIFA turn the lights on over there a little bit more often and hold them to account on spending it on their women's team.
Well, certainly, you know, I said it was there wasn't much to talk about in the St. Kitts and Nevis v. Canada game, but the one thing that jumped out to me is that that team qualified for this tournament, which says a lot about the quality of the rest of the Caribbean teams. Now,
correct.
Exactly. TNT, why did they not get there with the budget that they provide on the men's side? It seems absurd, of course. Let's move to a good story in the Caribbean, though, and that would be Haiti. And they have, in recent years, stepped it up across the board on both the men's and the women's side. They have done well in the youth tournaments, and certainly against the United States, I think they surprised a lot of people. We'll talk about the American side of it in a minute, but before we do that, Jonathan, do you think that Haiti's on the right way forward, or was this a one-off result? I mean, 4-0 victory, but that's still very noble considering, I would say.
The impressions that I get are that they're on the right way forward. We need to see where their younger players go. Do they have opportunities to continue playing? Do some of them maybe get college scholarships in the United States to play here, which will hopefully help make them better and then bring them some exposure to either European teams or the NWSL? We're going to find out. But Haiti certainly represented itself playing well against the United States. They frustrated them. They were cohesive defensively and had a good game plan. It's going to be very interesting to see. Obviously, we're recording this before the Haiti-Costa Rica game. But Haiti-Costa Rica is going to be a game where we're going to see whether the defensive cohesion that Haiti has and their ability to play together can cause a stir and maybe an upset. Costa Rica has the better individual talent. Players like Shirley Cruz and Raquel Rodriguez. And I think this is now a very interesting and maybe even, as we would say, a live game, the winner of which is going to be on the way to second place. We'll find out.
Yeah, I found the Costa Rican game very interesting to watch, too. Their win over Panama quite handily, 6-1. They're very technically skilled, the Costa Rican team, but I still wonder about whether they have the athleticism to step up in this region and compete with the very top teams. And I think Haiti will offer them a unique challenge that way, because I think the one thing Haiti does quite well is they can match these clubs at their teams athletically, and I believe that we're going to learn a lot from that matchup. You're absolutely right, but let's turn our attention to the Americans now. A win's a win's a win, and that's ultimately the goal in a competition like this. You're just trying to get to Tokyo and put the pieces together and look at some players and do all the things right. No one thinks the United States is not going to make the Olympics. But yet there was some concern after the closeness of that win. Is that just American fans looking for something to be concerned about? Because let's face it, there's not a lot often. Or was there something there?
I think that there was a little something there in this regard. When the starting lineup came out and I saw the front three was Lynn Williams, Carly Lloyd, and Kristen Press, I looked at it and I said, well, that's interesting. Because now you had on the bench Lindsey Horan, Tobin Heath, Megan Rapinoe, and a pile of other players who are, you know, some of the very best the Americans had. Well, it turned out that Heath was a little bit injured. Rapinoe wasn't quite at full health either. And that's part of why they didn't start. But the result was a U.S. team that by its own admission was a little too linear and a little too predictable. And that was certainly something that I noticed and that they noticed, too, to their credit, and said, hey, we had to fix that. And I don't think it was a coincidence that when Rapinoe came into the game, things opened up a little bit because she could break down some players one-on-one and do some things that were not. Lynn Williams is a good player, but she's a bit of a straight line. By her own admission, she's a straight line player. She plays as a striker for the North Carolina Courage, not as a winger. So, you know, she played all right. She played, you know, she had a goal and an assist that, as everybody saw, her left shoe came flying off as she was about to deliver the assist with the right foot. I think they'll be fine. I think that, you know, when you're the opponent, the one thing you do is for the U.S. to be annoyed about themselves or anything that they might cause to be annoyed about. Now they're going to be annoyed, so good luck to Haiti.
That is true. I think certainly the United States does play much better when they have have a chip on their shoulder when they're have something that can focus them a little bit more. You mentioned Rapinoe. There has been times over the past year that she's had the Midas touch for sure. She's untouchable. She seems like she wears a cape. But is there going to come a point where you can't just lean back and hope that she can fly in and change things on a dime? Do you have to rely less on her if you're going to win a gold medal this summer?
Well, they have such a depth of talent that I'm inclined to think the answer to that is yes. And there is a of younger players who are coming up through the ranks now. And so that when Rapinoe and also Tobin Heath is another one, when they go, the drop-off is not going to be as great as some people might fear. Now, it won't be quite the same individual one-on-one creativity, and some of that creativity is now going to reside in the middle of the park instead of on the wings, which is going to change how the U.S. plays some. But I'll take Rose Lavelle, Lindsey Horan, Sam Mewis, and so on, and take my chances because they're just so good.
Yeah, most countries, they could put three teams in, as we all know, and compete for gold with all three. Jonathan, what is realist? What is the U.S. hoping to gain from this tournament? It's always tough when you're looking at a CONCACAF opponents. As you say, even Canada might push them a little, but it's more like, you know, that's the mosquito you're swatting aside. The other bugs aren't even landing on the skin, usually. What realistically can the U.S. gain from this event that will help them in their goal to become the first women's team to win both the Olympic gold medal the year following a World Cup win?
Well, it's pretty simple. They have to get their pool down to 18 players for the Olympics. And these games are going to tell, you know, it's down to 20 for qualifying. There are a couple who are not on the qualifying roster, specifically Casey Short and Mallory Pugh, who still have shots to go to Tokyo. And this is going to tell who makes the cut. And that's, you know, that's what needs to happen. As we've discussed before, it's 18 players. It's not very much. And you know, that's what's going to come out of this, I suspect.
Well, we haven't talked with Mallory Pugh on this show yet. That is a conversation that is a lot of people are having. So be interested. I think our listeners will be as well to hear your take on her omission from the roster.
Well, I think that the answer would be that she was, you know, the 21st player out of 20. In a lot of ways. But she did stall some with the national team and with her club, the Washington Spirit. She got traded on draft day to Sky Blue FC. And the hope from Vlatko Ananovski and a lot of other people is that that's going to light a little bit of a spark under her and get her going. She's certainly going to have no lack of opportunities, you know, with Carly Lloyd playing next to her and Pugh playing the provider to Lloyd. You know, if Vlatko Ananovski says, you know, give me six assists in the first 8 to 10 weeks of the season, and then let's talk. I think that's a legitimate goal to have, and I think Pugh can do it. We're going to find out.
Fair enough. All right, as we turn our attention to wrap the show up to the next four games in this event, I mean, what do you think if you were going to pick one of the four? And some of our listeners, as you say, will pick this up after the fact. But if you are listening to this on Friday afternoon before the games take place, well, what game excites you the most over the next round of fixtures?
Well, I think it has to be Jamaica-Canada. You know, just to see what Jamaica's going to do. You know, if we assume that Canada is going to sweep the board, you know, will Jamaica be able to take a point off them? Will Mexico be able to take a point off them? We're going to find out. You know, Jamaica needs Mexico to trip up here in order to get out, and I'm not sure they're going to, and it's going to be a problem because if Jamaica doesn't qualify for the Olympics, I'm very worried about what the Jamaican Federation is going to do in these sort of quiet years when there's not a major international tournament. I fear that they might shut the program down, and that would be a big problem.
Certainly that is a fear and something we've seen in other cases before. You know, if you only have a limited amount of resources coming from a third party, then it does make sense. You're going to pay attention to the World Cup, but it is truly, I don't think any of our listeners would disagree, a shame that would happen. This should be on the Federation. How much, to wrap it up, let me ask you this, Jonathan. How much of it should be on the Federation alone, and how much of it should be on CONCACAF as a region to step up and maybe even directly assist some of these smaller programs? Well, I don't know if Jamaica's small, but you know what I mean. How much of it is it on them to step up and make sure that these programs are funded correctly?
Well, I think it is certainly it's majority on the JFF, the Jamaican Federation. But CONCACAF has an ability to wield some power here. And I think, you know, they could, if they wanted to, they could say, hey, you want to host the Caribbean Cup on the men's side? Well, fund your women's program proper. The money is there, I would argue, from FIFA and CONCACAF, et cetera, to do this. And somebody needs to hold Jamaica to account to make sure that it is used, because they do have talent. They substantially have some talent in that program, and it needs to be allowed to grow and develop and flourish. And they have a fan base too, by the way. They have gotten that country's attention.
And, as they should. Yeah. As they should. Jonathan, obviously the United States would not benefit from this, and maybe there's a way to work around it. Canada probably wouldn't even benefit from it. But is there a need for a CONCACAF to step up and create a Nations League on the women's side for the countries that are outside of the top two?
I don't know. I don't know that a Nations League per se is going to solve the problem. Now, a well-run Caribbean Cup, you know, CONCACAF has these sort of sub-regions in Central America and the Caribbean, you know, the Caribbean Football Union and UNCAF, I think the other one is.
Yeah.
Have step up and have some tournaments, you know, in those sub-regions. Maybe for this purpose, put Mexico in with UNCAF, which they're not on the men's side because they don't need to be, but on the women's side, it would benefit them. And have some tournaments and go play. Sure.
I think that's all. We just want to see them have this chance to play, Jonathan. I think we all agree with that, because as much as we support and love the women's game, these tournaments aren't that fun to watch. Watching Canada win 11-0 is not entertaining, and that's, I think, probably why the attendances are so low in Houston. There's marketing issues there too, but you want competition ultimately, as fun as it is to win.
Well, and the other thing about Olympic qualifying is, if you're CONCACAF, you have to play it in warm weather locations. They seemed, I guess, what was it, World Cup qualifying, they had a group stage in Edinburgh. Because Edinburgh, which is almost at the very southern tip of Texas at the Mexico border, they wanted the Mexico fans to go, and they sort of did. But, you know, if it's tough because it's not really a major market. It's the right size stadium, but it's not really a soccer market of the kind of place where people would show up to go watch the games, you know, just to go.
Yeah.
There's plenty of places in the United States, and they aren't all in warm weather locations, I realize, where, and granted, CONCACAF doesn't do a ton of marketing on this, but, you know, where people would show up to say, hey, I want to go watch a couple of soccer games. Let's go.
They did have it at BC Place in 2015, for the 2012 Olympics, but we don't want to have a turf debate, I don't think, Jonathan. So
no.
Maybe we'll leave it at that. All right, this has been Women's Soccer Review. We'll probably have an extra one in here next week after the second round of games. Depends on scheduling. Jonathan, before we say goodbye, let the listeners know where they can follow your work.
I'm on Twitter at The Goalkeeper, and my stuff on Philadelphia Inquirer's website is at inquirer.com/soccer. If you go to my Twitter feed, you will see the Inquirer is having a pretty big subscription sale at the moment, tied to the other football going on these days. 54 weeks of digital access to our website. Go give a book.
Cool. And I'm 24th Minute Dwayne Rollins. You can listen to me daily on Soccer Today, our flagship show on the Sports Podcasting Network, at 11 a.m. Eastern, where we talk about the world of football from a soccer perspective. This has been the Women's Soccer Review. Until next time, have a good soccer.